Good evening. Well, last week we finished the Precious Mirror Samadhi Sutra poem, mysterious poem. Some of you weren't here for the finish. I think those talks are online, so you can catch up that way. And if you haven't read them yet, you can know for sure that it ended happily ever after. So what I announced last week is my intention to devote a couple of Tuesday evenings, this one to start, talking about our practice, especially the details of how we do when we practice together. If we're practicing by ourselves, we can make up any kind of schedule that we want to, and many of us have done this. You can go up to the Vedanta Center in Point Reyes and have a wonderful week there in your own room with your own bathroom and a view out into the meadows and the forest of Point Reyes and create your own schedule completely. Or go down to Vajrapani down in Boulder Creek. Wonderful. You get a little cabin up on a hill with a great view. They bring you food, but you don't see them. They just leave it out there for you. You can do that for some days also. And you don't have to make a written out schedule the way we do, saying, well, 40 minutes for sitting and 10 minutes for walking and so much for lunch and all of those things. You can create a flow from your own being as you experience your meditation practice. Not just sitting, but standing and walking and lying down, all of them. And completely be a world of meditation for a while. You can do it at home, as I've often said. It's if you have the home to yourself for a little while, you can turn it into a zendo, your own private zendo, and make it your way. Sit until you don't feel like sitting anymore. You don't need a bell or a clock. It's you. We have a bell and a clock because we're all sitting together, and it's a little chaotic if we're all getting up and sitting down at different times. Though there are retreats that do that, and that is a way that it can be done, where everybody quietly gets up and then quietly sits down again and quietly walks. There are any number of ways of doing this. And the only reason we have it organized at all is so that we can share the space and do it together. Not just because we keep each other, warm and cozy, but because we inspire each other. Everyone's practice is an inspiration. And we learn so much from each other. So in order to have some sort of cohesion, we create a practice. And every place is a little different. So I just want to review what our practice is, and it is what I learned at Haiku Zendo from Koban. And Koban brought it from his childhood in Kamo, a little village in northern Japan, where his father was an abbot of a teaching monastery and his temple, which is still there. And I've heard that Bune is going to start a teaching monastery there again. So it's been going on for hundreds of years up there. And he trained at Eheji Monastery, So he brought the Aheji style, which is why ours is just like the San Francisco Zen Center, only not as fancy. Coben cut a lot of it out, but it's basically the same as San Francisco Zen Center, which is from Aheji. So, I want to refer to this wonderful little book of Darlene's again. It's called The Dharma Gate of Ease and Joy, Zazen for Everybody. Beautiful little book. I think you were going to talk to Beata and get some more copies. Beata just handed this to me. And so I've been enjoying it tremendously ever since. And the book I always recommend is called The Posture of Meditation, which is very much like this in her. I think she picked up from it and brought her own experience into it, a vast experience that she's had, and very body-oriented because of her condition. She was in terrible pain the whole of her life and managed it in the most generous ways. So, posture is essential, but mostly impossible. I mean, we can't get a perfect posture, even though we long to. The perfect posture, of course, is the original yogic lotus, full lotus posture. Actually, this is all yoga. This is how we begin yoga, is with meditation. And full lotus is the original position. They found drawings and little sculptures of people from the earliest people in India, long before Hinduism or Buddhism became a part of India, where full lotus is being sat. So it's very, very ancient. And it's a discovery that we can most easily stay in one place for a long time. It's very, very stable. But it's not perfect because one leg is on top of the other, like this, and so you're a little tweaked. So you have to change, if you're able to do this, you have to change from one side to the other, put the other one on top in order to keep your backbone straight. Otherwise, you become twisted. That's true also in sitting half lotus. If you sit with one leg up and one on the ground, like Abhijit's doing now, then you need to switch and put the other one on the ground and the other one up on your leg, or on the cushion as he's doing. Best way for us long-leggeds usually is to sit parallel, with our legs parallel. It's called the Burmese position. And that too, you switch, one in the front and then another in the front. And if you sit these ways, you can sit for a long time because you can breathe that way and you don't feel so tippy. You're being held. It's pretty hard if you're not on a cushion. There's some people who just sit flat on the ground, but we really need to elevate the spine in order to keep the whole thing together, I want to say, integrated. And also to make sure that the belly has comes forward. If it's back like this, then the belly gets very tight, and you want it to be soft and vulnerable. So any kind of upright sitting, including on a chair, I'm very glad to be sitting in a chair as an object lesson to anybody who is going to break an ankle or do something that requires that they not sit on a cushion anymore. Some people get so wedded to the cushion they feel that they can't sit without it, but it's not so. You can sit lying down. As Darlene says, the best way to sit lying down is with your knees up and your hands on your belly so that you can feel the rising and falling of your breath. And then if you fall asleep, which you're likely to do because your body's primed to fall asleep when it's prone, your legs fall over and wake you up. So remember that. I have a friend who was in an accident at Yosemite, and he spent a couple of months in the hospital, and he was figuring out all kinds of different ways of breathing flat on his back. When he couldn't get up at all, he would breathe through his toes. He was just out like this, and he would just feel his breath coming all the way up and all the way down again. And it kept him going. Darlene says, the most important part of it is alignment. And she quotes Suzuki Roshi in a very nice little riff here, where he says, no, it's fine, thank you. You should sit with your whole body, your spine, mouth, toes, mudra. Check on your posture during zazen. Each part of your body should practice zazen independently or separately. You should feel each part of your body doing zazen independently. Each part of your body should participate completely in zazen. This is known as shikantaza. If you think that you have a difficulty in some part of your body, then the rest of the body should help that part that is in difficulty. You are not having difficulty with some part of your body, but the part of the body is having difficulty. For example, your mudra is having difficulty. Your whole body should help your mudra do zazen. The entire universe is doing zazen in the same way that your body is doing zazen. When all parts of your body are practicing zazen, then that is how the whole universe practices zazen. Each mountain and each river is going and flowing independently. All parts of the universe are participating in their practice. The mountain practices independently. The river practices independently. Thus, the whole universe practices independently. So, alignment is basically what Dogen always pointed out, that you line up your nose with your navel and tuck your chin, make sure your ears are even with your shoulders, and that you've got a little curve at your waist, not a big curve, but just enough that you're forward a bit, so that your knees are holding you and your spine is. You've got a triangle with your two knees and your spine. And this is true in a chair also, except it's your spine and your feet that are the triangle with these big old knees in the way. So your connection in chair sitting is with the floor. And you start and end with the feeling of the floor as well as the feeling of the chair. So you're held. And you're wavery in a chair. You do kind of like a blade of grass in the wind a little bit. But you get used to it. So you want to align yourself as best you can. And everyone has back problems and knee problems and shoulder problems that always show up. So just work with what you have and adjust as your life goes on, because it will change. And it's well to notice the changes and take it into account. So from alignment, then we go on to stability, stillness, balance between all the parts, as Suzuki Roshi said. It's not just the mind and the body. It's this amazing, all these things happening continually as we sit and breathe. And then dynamic tension. She always talked a lot about that, Darlene, about the kind of vitality that's required. When Buddha taught, one of his first teachings was the Satipatthana Sutra, which was the mindfulness practice, noticing how the breathing is going, noticing what the air and how we feel what's happening around us, all those things, what our mind is up to, all these different aspects of this mind-body. And he said, with each instruction, with the breathing instruction, for instance, he said, ardent and fully aware, attend to whether your breathing is fast or slow. And if it's a fast breath, notice that it's a fast breath. And if it's a slow one, notice it's a slow one. But practice ardently and aware. And I think that's really important. It's easy just to come and sit down and sort of veg or recover from whatever we've been through during the day, which is often what happens just because we're so worn out. But if we can remember to that ardency, I think it will help to put some energy into what we're doing. And yes, she says, we should remember to be stable, sturdy, but not too stiff, to be vulnerable at the same time, and to be soft and receptive. We're often broadcasting ourselves so much, and sitting is our chance to begin to receive and learn to open ourselves to receive even more. And to be able to adjust ourselves, not to be so rigid and stiff that we harm ourselves, because we can hurt ourselves that way. But to notice how we naturally move. The breath is moving us. Everything is moving a little bit, and the ground under us is moving a little bit. So be sure in your stillness to notice how you move and allow it. And accept, but accept with that ardency and energy, so that it's alive. You know, there's that old Zen story. What is Zazen? What is Shikanpaza? Is it some kind of magic? No. Is it some kind of practice? Well, not really. What is it? It's alive. It's alive. Shikantaza means only just sitting. Shikan means only just. And ta means one-pointedness, you could say, like an arrow. Just here, just here, just here, actually. Za is zazen. So it's sitting just here. Just here. With open awareness, with the knowledge that anything could happen, and probably will. It's always a surprise. Even with our best intentions, we're always surprised. And as Kodo Tsawaki said, it is good for nothing. If we come to Zazen hoping for something, then we've already turned it into something else. So aspirations, goals, plans for ourself to get polished up, all fall away in Shikan Taza. They're unnecessary. None of us would be here if we hadn't experienced some kind of enlightenment. That's the beginning of practice, not the goal. So our practice is, once we've begun to connect, then it's natural for us to continue. It is, as I always say, like a child crawling who one day begins to pull herself up and try to walk. I've said this metaphor for years, and I just found it in an old Chinese story where some old Chinese master said the same thing. It's just like a baby crawling who stands up and walks. The baby doesn't decide to stand up and walk. The baby doesn't have a plan or a goal. The baby doesn't even know about walking. It just has to do it, is compelled. Our practice is like that. We can get pretty mixed up if we try to analyze our practice and figure out what it really is and what it means and what our life is in terms of it and all of those things, because it's not a thought thing, it's an experience. So then there's some etiquette involved. The bowing, the gashoing. Bowing is really prostrations, when we just fling ourselves down on the floor. And gasho is this, which is a kind of universal gesture. Often see people who have nothing to do with this kind of practice being grateful for something and doing gassho. And it's common in India, of course. You do this and say namaste for everything. You know, I see you. I see what I see, the real you. The God in you, you could say, or the divine. Namaste. Namaste is hello. It's like aloha, it's hello and goodbye. It brings both sides of the body together. It creates stability and balance. And it requires full attention to the other at the same time as you are fully attentive in your own wholeness. So gassho is really important, and we do a lot of it. We bow to our cushion, we bow to each other, we bow to the room when we come in, we bow to the room when we leave, we bow to our food. It's a wonderful practice. There's always this funny feeling in a restaurant, well, shall I bow to my food? Will this look funny? Sometimes I do, and sometimes not. But it's something we're given as a way of expressing our gratitude and our full acknowledgement of how things are with us, how it is that we live in this world from the benefit of all other beings. There's one bow that I want to change, and that's the one that at the end of the service that we just did, and we finished bowing and we stand up. Then we've all been bowing together because I said we should. But when I thought about it, when Donna Lynn is putting together this masterpiece of instructions on how to do all of the Doan and Sogu and all of the practices that go into making Sesshin, and I read that and I thought, that's not really right. Because the Doshi, the one who's serving the altar, is standing right in the line of the altar itself. And so she bows to the altar to say goodbye and then steps back and everybody bows together. So that first bow, I think, is just for the Doshi and not for everybody. And we'll all forget, and that's okay. But we can remember, I think it would be, it just seems more correct to me. So then, yes.
First bow, last bow. I always thought we do prostration and then we bow. Maybe that's not
right. No? We do three prostrations.
Is that for each one you bow? Or is that just going into it?
It's just going into it.
I always thought that last one was part of the last bow. So it's a separate bow. You bow together after.
After, yeah. Yeah, and that's what we've been doing, is bowing together after those three prostrations.
And it's also when there's no veil. You have that. The bow of the Doshi before you step back.
Yes, yes.
The bell is telling all of us, right?
That's right. It's for everybody. So you bow on the bell, but I bow without the bell. And I keep Gassho in the beginning of the chanting of the sutra also, even though nobody else does, until we get to the prajna part.
Now, this is after the chanting we're talking about, right?
Yes.
Now, what about before the chanting? There's three prostrations, and there is a before we start the chanting, before you go to chop. There is a half bow, right? Three prostrations, and then half bow, and then we start.
Yeah,
the
yeah,
now,
yeah.
What does that mean?
It's just kind of closing up of the bowing part.
So that one is okay.
Yeah, yeah. It's just a little bit. But at the end, I think before I leave, then I do one and then step back, and then we all bow together. And when we bow together, you all are bowing to the altar. So you turn and face the altar to do that first bow. And then you turn around and face each other and bow to each other on the second bow. And on the third bell, when I turn around and we're in Shashu, then we all bow to each other. And you're bowing with the teacher the third time. So it's to the altar first, to each other second, and then all of us together.
These are prostrations, right?
No, these are just Gassho. After the prostrations,
yes.
then there's a little ding.
Yeah, the three little dings.
The three little dings, yeah. Yeah.
And you change your position.
Yes.
I was Brit there, first that way, and then to the altar, then.
Yes. Yeah. So that's about all I've got. And I've got room for questions because I thought there might... Oh, there's 2 minutes left for questions. Ah, shame. Anyway, there's time. Is there more to... I want to go into chanting and the sutras next week and practice chanting and do the kanji zai. I think Claire knows how to do the makugyo, and I thought we could try it out. And try maybe the dahi shindarani also with makugyo. And chanting, I've got some material that Coben said about chanting that I would love to share with you all also that will help us. So we can go through the service. I thought if we went through the service and talked about it as we went through it, that would be helpful also. Donalyn?
Just about the service. It's different here because we don't have incense, we don't have candles, and so what we do at Shashin is different than what we do here, but it's the same service. I mean,
yes.
The same essence, but Angie has modified it just ever so slightly because we don't have incense and candles. And then our Saturday service is even different. It's a modification of a true Shashin service, why a Tuesday night is an abbreviated service, I guess you could say. So that's what's confusing, but you know, it's a logistical thing. And it's essentially
we could serve the altar. I could serve the altar the way we do in Sesshin, of going up and offering potpourri or something, except that our altar is way down there, and so you feel like a monster. It really isn't appropriate to loom over a bodhisattva or a Buddha. It's just too much.
Is there any way we can just include it next week, maybe get a chair or something? I'm very curious for all the, you know, you do this, you walk around, you do that. To me, it would be very nice to know what you're doing and why.
Oh, let's do that. Sure, we can put it on a chair.
Follow whatever she's doing. Right. With great respect, but it would mean a lot more to know where it came from.
Sure, sure.
So we can rig it up higher or whatever.
Yeah, it's mostly about creating more incense. Every time the priest goes up to the altar, she just takes some more and puts it on the hot coal, and it goes up again. So when prajna is mentioned, then the priest has to be right there and adding more.
So that's every time we do the bell on prajna paramita, that's what it's actually happening?
That's the signal to go up and offer incense. Yeah. And then when you're done, there's another prajna and bow and go back. Usually those bells are just signals for the priest to remember to do something. Let's do that. We'll go through it.
Would you like a little collapsible table to bring it up to the altar, up to the proper level, and you can take it, just carry it to and from here, when you have the altar up there?
Do you have one we could borrow?
We used to have one, and then when we sold the house, we gave it all. I'm just thinking, Goodwill must have.
Oh, maybe so.
Hmm.
Oh, a TV tray would do it.
No, it's not a table.
No, they're a one-person thing. My parents had those.
Yeah,
that's...
I have an antique TV tray that my parents gave me. That's made of wood. Really lovely. I'd love to bring it in one. Give it a try. I think it should be the right size.
Oh, thank you, Jeffrey. All right. Great.
That's been my practice this last month. So I don't get to come on Saturdays because my practice is cleaning out my garage. And I don't get to come to sessions because my practice is taking 100 boxes out of my attic. And my practice is, you talk about your practice is your life.
Yes.
That's what you do.
Well, that's what John's just been through also.
I have looked at a month of my karma.
I know what it's like. Your whole life in your attic and your garage.
So I've seen that antique TV tray and would love to have a place for it.
Okay, wonderful.
Energy?
Yes.
Today on a Buddhist blog, one of my favorites, Karen Mason Miller, mentioned Koban. She started her blog with that. I brought it along, it's very short, can I read it?
Yeah, sure.
Yes. The more you sense the rareness and value of your own life, the more you realize that how you use it, how you manifest it, is all your responsibility. We face such a big task, so naturally, we sit down for a while. And that's what she used because she wanted to talk about her practice, which I thought was timely because that's what we're talking about.
Yeah. Thank you. I know that one very well.
She hadn't read it. She didn't know. So it was the first time she came upon it. It was like, it really set her off.
Yeah.
And,